You will remember last week's Newsweek cover story, the war over fetal rights. There were some amazing pictures in there of babies in the womb. And we talked with a few people regarding that particular story. We talked with Scott Klusendorf. He said that on the whole, he believed that to be a pretty balanced representation. There was even a pro and a con sidebar on fetal rights. On the pro side was Hadley Arkus, a regular guest here on Issues Etc. We'll be talking with him about the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the resurgence of the whole debate over fetal rights during the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the second hour of the program, we'll be talking with Pastor Will Whedon. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Part one of a 10-part series on the liturgy. In this first part, all we will do is try to explain what the liturgy is and how it is scriptural. That's part one of a 10-part series. We'll be beginning with him and running through the summer, Pastor Will Whedon, in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, Pastor David Shaddy of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Indianapolis joins us to talk about fatherhood. Of course, this weekend, Father's Day is rolling back around again. Fatherhood will be the subject in the last hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hadley Arkus is professor of jurisprudence at Amherst College. He's the Vaughn Fellow and in the James Madison program at Princeton University, author of the new book Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, and architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, Todd, it's almost like home, being back with my friends at this station. You guys have been just terrific.
Hadley, I've got to ask you, what do you think about the picture that they put there in your sidebar in the Newsweek article? It's a rather close-up of you.
Yes, I thought it was pretty grim, but we're getting... You know, they took 3.5 hours. A wonderful young man was shooting pictures. Could you believe 3.5 hours? I said, look, this is not Audrey Hepburn. What are we talking about? And so one of my friends said, yeah, that's why. It wouldn't take 3.5 hours. But you know, I thought it was a mark of malevolence. And yet friends kept calling and saying, no. The eyes look very lively, and the mouth looks sensitive. My wife, no, we still think, you know, it wasn't very flattering, but it turns out, remarkably, that very slim interview really has seemed to have had an effect. I've had lots of calls and even a letter from a very urbane friend in New York, a wife of one of my friends, who professed to be a fence sitter on the question of abortion and fetal rights, and she said she was tipped over by that. And that's
really?
Yeah.
That is very good news.
Very interesting.
Now, in response to the first question there in that brief interview, the question was just basically, what rights does a fetus have? They were asking you to enumerate certain rights, but you respond with a question that I thought was simply brilliant, and that is, on what grounds would one consider a child in the womb as anything less than a human being? Why did you respond that way?
That's right. First, you know, when we had this interview on television, on radio, talking about fetal rights, I said, oh, by the way, I do want to be clear, we're talking about not a fetal pig, but a human fetus, right? Yes. Ah, so we're clear that the offspring never undergoes a change of species anywhere along the chain, right? It's never more or less human at any point, so that the 60-year-old is not more human than the 5-year-old or the newborn. And I was simply trying to point that out, that there's no ground of principle we could cite to establish why that child in the womb is anything less than a human being. That wouldn't apply to many people walking around well outside the womb. So as I told my interlocutor, Professor Steinbuch, rather missed the point. I said, to ask what rights a fetus has is rather comparable to asking, well, what rights does a first grader or a newborn have? They wouldn't have the same right to a driver's license, to sell stock, but in its right not to have its life taken for casual reason, simply to serve the interests of anyone else, its fundamental right there really wouldn't be dependent on its height, its weight, its degree of articulateness. That's essentially the kind of point I was making.
And then I guess in response to the plain question, what rights does a human fetus have, you would, I guess, respond with all of the fundamental rights that all human beings possess?
Sure, in a sense, again, it's not the right to use the squash courts. You know? I mean, these are little, we have rights that are created out of local associations, right? The right to use the pool. But you know that example I used to use? The visitor who comes in off the plane from New York, he lands in New York, and we understand that he wouldn't have to see his passport before we protected him against a lawless assault on the street. His right not to be attacked would not depend on his citizenship. It would be implicit in his human standing. We wouldn't think that the same man could go over to the City College of New York and get some subsidized rate of tuition that the people of New York make available to one another. So I think what we're really fastened on is, those, you know, in the 19th century, statesmen used to talk about the rights that arise from governments and those rights that arise from nature. What kinds of rights and wrongs can we talk about inflicting on anyone or anyone could claim? And in the right, say, not to suffer an injury without justification, not to have my life taken for flippant reasons, that doesn't depend on your citizenship or your location.
We have heard, of course, the arguments that are put forth, and they sound, in light of what you've just said, pretty specious. Who would say, well, look, if the fetus has rights, every right that everyone else possesses, who is not a fetus, that kind of status there, people have said, well, then why can't a fetus buy a house or take out a loan or,
well,
as you said, drive a car?
But interesting, though the fetus, the child in the womb could be considered the inheritor of property, right? As soon as the child is conceived, before the person donating the property dies, you know, we have cases like that where the child, you know, once conceived, we know it's there, and it's born, becomes the inheritor of the property. And a child could have standing against, the unborn child could have standing against a negligent driver. So we have this, you know, curious mix in our law in which we accord recognition to the standing of the being in the womb as an entity that can receive the protections of the law, that has claims in the law, and yet wouldn't have claim against a surgeon seeking to take its life. You know, we had this came up with a woman calling in a program from Boston the other day, where I thought, God, this is really such an inversion. We said, well, the child isn't born yet, and so on. It used, up to 30 years ago, it used to be understood that the pregnant woman was in a position, uniquely, to go to the rescue and offer nurturance of this very vulnerable human being within her power. And now it's taken as a virtual license to destroy someone who is uniquely dependent on you. I see, you know, there's a moral, you know, inversion that's come along with that. Now, let's say we didn't talk about this. We didn't cast the terms in rights of the fetus or the rights of the unborn child. It seems to be cast rather in terms of the duty of someone who is in a position of power, who is uniquely placed to effect a rescue, the duty of that person to render care and go to the aid of the innocent.
What of this concept also raised in the Newsweek interview of viability? What do you make of that particular argument?
That is one of the most specious things that, let's go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, someone we don't often invoke on these sessions. Remember, Rousseau, in the opening pages of The Social Contract, alerted us to the point of the right of might makes right, the notion that the fact that some people succeed in securing power over others does not itself establish the justification for that power. As any kid knows who's been beaten up, that the success of some people in beating him up doesn't establish the rightness of doing it. And yet what we've been asked to accept now with this argument over viability is that as an unborn child is dependent, as it's weak and dependent, its weakness does not summon our efforts or obligation to protect it. Its weakness becomes the very ground on which we extinguish its rights and claim a license to kill it for virtually any reason sufficient to us. It is, in fact, backing into the notion of might makes right. So as I pointed out in that discussion the other day, we've never accepted the notion that dependency, is a sufficient ground for homicide. I think it's just remarkable how, once again, people fancying that they're doing something new with some new cliche manage to back into moral fallacies that are quite ancient.
You mentioned some remarkable inconsistencies that exist in the law.
Right.
And one of them being highlighted, of course, by the Lacey and Connor Peterson double murder case out in California.
Oh, boy. Right.
There, tell us a little bit of some of your observations on that big news story that has brought again to the fore this debate over fetal rights.
Well, I did testify in Congress, I think it was, '99 or 2000, on the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, the act, the federal act presented by our friend Lindsey Graham. And the curious thing about this is that the feminists want the ideological screen comes down. We have this Sergeant Robbins, I think it's a sergeant in the Air Force, who beat up his pregnant wife, killed the child, and the Judge Advocate Corps didn't think it had a legal ground for prosecuting for the killing of the child. And we have Mr. Lentz, who lost his wife pregnant with their unborn son in the bombing at Oklahoma City. He is convinced that two people were killed. You put this, yet this thing comes to Congress, and you have people like Zoe Lofgren of California and other feminists getting up to argue, no, only a woman has been assaulted. They're very much afraid that we make any kind of concession to the presence of that child in the womb. We undermine their whole structure of argument and rights and under Roe versus Wade, and of course they're right, even though this can't reach Roe versus Wade. But the interesting thing about this, Todd, is the ideological screen comes down. It is plain to anyone with eyes to see that someone was killed in these incidents. Not merely that a woman was assaulted, bad as enough as that is, but the ideological screen comes down, and these people have to deny what is plainly within view. Someone got killed. In the case of Lacey Martin and the child, two bodies washed up. Somebody else was killed. And the interesting thing is that the feminists have put themselves in such a brittle condition that their ideological position depends on their denying what is plainly before the eyes of anyone, what anyone could see. Now, none of this, strictly speaking, we're dealing with, curiously, they have to deny the standing even to an unborn child who happens to be wanted by the mother. Mrs. Robbins wanted the child. They can't give any concession to that. And so the curious thing is, even if you pass the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, it's not likely that anything in that act could furnish the ground on which a court or any official body could disallow an abortion chosen by a woman. But so why is it that the feminists and the partisans of abortion are so exercised by this and so panicky over it? And the simple reason is that it simply puts into place recognitions and premises that make it clear that the whole ground of their position in arguing for rights of abortion is simply incoherent, just indefensible.
You mentioned before the other sidebar that was placed as kind of a counterpoint to the one in which you were interviewed in the Newsweek article, and it was Bonnie Steinbach who was being interviewed there. She was asked the question, what rights does a fetus have? Her response was, well, context is the determiner here, and it seems as though the context she believes is determinative of whether or not a fetus has rights is the will of the mother. Explain that argument to us and respond to it.
Well, that's all it is. It finally reduces to that. I don't recall everything she said, but as the thing came out in conversation, she wouldn't contest the notion that the offspring is human at every stage, but she wanted to insist that the child acquires more claim on us as it becomes more recognizably human, which is, depends then not on anything about the child itself, but our perceptions, how we see the child. And she kept using standards of self-awareness of the child, that the child has to acquire interests. And we're never able to get back to this point, but the critical response is that, well, give us some measure of self-awareness. Give us any measure of self-awareness you would use in relation to the child that would not apply to many newborns and young people as well. Or what is it about what kind of interest? How does a child acquire an interest? And why couldn't you say that the unborn child has an interest, a profound interest, in its life and not having its life taken for casual or flippant reasons. The difficulty with this is that as these people concede that there's no change of species, and we're well away from Aristotelian biology. We no longer think that the offspring goes from a vegetative state to an animal state before it becomes human. We know it is never anything less than human at any stage. So they want to say that it becomes more clearly human as it acquires these features or these attributes that we recognize. But again, these are attributes that seem to be important to us in our view of the child. And it doesn't really have any bearing on the question of what is this entity? Quite apart from how we see it, what it looks like to us, what is it? I think that's a critical point.
Last week when the Newsweek story came out, we talked with Scott Klusendorf, and he pointed out something that I think is crucial. I'd like your reaction to it. He said very often the argument is allowed to drift from whether or not the fetus is a human being to whether or not the fetus is a person, and then all sorts of
exactly.
Along with what you were saying,
all sorts of
qualifications on what makes a person come into play. Why is that a dangerous place to go in the argument?
Well, first of all, because it doesn't really bear on the question of whether we're dealing with a human being. And what it means is then that you're willing to make you're not really describing somebody. You're not applying, being in other words, and saying, well, that's not a snark, it's a bojum. That's not a human being. That's a black man or a nigger, as this thing. You know, you flip the labels. You're not simply describing. When you make a shift of that kind, you're suggesting that this being lacks something that removes it then from the whole class of beings protected by the law. You say, well, what can have that kind of significance? Can't be anything like height and weight, degrees of articulateness. I mean, they make very interesting differences. But you can't say that because somebody's a little slower, somebody's a little more quicker of wit, someone's more perceptive, someone's a little duller, that you'd be justified in taking someone's life for any of these reasons. They simply can't bear that kind of a burden. Now, the point I also made in regard to Professor Steinbuch, and just to fill in your last question, is that interesting thing, as these people say, it has more of a claim on us, as the baby looks more human. And you put the question to them, all right, are you in fact willing to protect the child at that? Are you willing to restrict an abortion? Because when it comes down to it, it really doesn't matter what stage it is. Whether we're dealing with something that is an embryo that's, you know, an inch long or something, or a baby whose features are fully discernible in a sonogram, when it comes down to it, Professor Steinbuch, as I understand it, these other people finally are not willing to protect that child from a killing if the pregnant woman, for any reason sufficient to herself, is willing to order it up, which is to say it simply comes back to that point you articulated just a few moments ago. It's Nietzsche and the triumph of the will. She willed it. Her interests are dominant. Those interests of hers soar above any discipline of giving reasons or justifications to show why her judgment in this case is defensible.
Another ban on partial birth abortion was recently passed through the House, very similar to the one in the Senate. It's expected to have a pretty easy time in conference committee and go to the president's desk.
Yeah.
What do you think this particular ban, how will it fare when it is challenged in the courts?
No, it's going nowhere because it's just going to be enjoined. It's because the same doctors who claim to be chilled by a state law on partial birth abortion will go to the same federal court, before the same friendly federal judge, and claim to be just as chilled by this law, even though we haven't had any chance to see how it works in practice. They'll claim to be chilled, and they'll get the same injunction stopping the enforcement of the law, and that's going to be stuck for a couple of years. The interesting thing is, we're waiting on a decision, maybe a change in the Supreme Court before anything can happen. Remember that we had Stenberg versus Carhart in June 2003, years ago, in which, by a very narrow decision of 5-4, the Supreme Court struck down the bill on partial birth abortion in Nebraska. And by inference, in all the other states that passed bills of this kind. The Congress tried to tinker with it a bit, but I don't think tinkering is going to have much of an effect. In the meantime, it has had the virtue of just putting the issue once again before the public. There exists a further danger in that the bill was cast in terms of the Commerce Clause, and since that bill was first introduced in 1995, we've had conservatives on the Supreme Court restricting the reach of the Commerce Clause, and we can have the curious, awkward situation of losing a couple of conservative votes on this one. What I find really quite too bad about all this is that in the meantime, we did pass last year the Born Alive Infants Protection Act,
mm-hmm.
This station was a leader in the media in covering. I don't know of anyone else who really gave the coverage to that bill that you and you, Todd, did, and along with Jeb Swartz. That bill turns out to be a powerful lever that we could use right now, threatening to withhold federal funds from any clinics that may be engaged in that kind of refusal to preserve the lives of children who survive abortions. It can have threatening to remove tax exemptions from any clinics or institutions, hospitals that could be involved. That could have a powerful effect. And in that case, remember, all the Democrats voted for it. So we could come back to them and say, we never added penalties to this bill. You all voted for it. Now, what do you think should be the penalty for someone who kills a child born alive who survives an abortion?
Hadley, I've got one more question for you. I'd love to be able to continue on that subject, but I want to give you at least 30 seconds here at the very end to tell us about your book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose.
Well, it's in part a sweep of the American law and how we've talked ourselves out of the logic of natural rights, and it has in part a memoir of the politics of advancing that bill on the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, but it crystallizes in this way, natural rights and the rights to choose, that as members of the political class have talked themselves into that logic of abortion rights or that right to choose, they've talked themselves out of the logic of natural rights, which means they can't assume that any of us has an intrinsic dignity that becomes the source of natural rights, rights that everyone else is obliged to respect. And so the awkward thing turns out to be this, that even if there is such a thing called a right to abortion, they've removed the moral substance of it. So they can't vindicate. It's simply a right conferred by the powerful, which could be withdrawn when it no longer suits the interests of the powerful. And the people who've talked themselves into that right to choose have put themselves in a position where they can't vindicate that right or any other right because they have essentially talked themselves out of the moral logic or the moral substance of rights.
Hadley Arkus, thank you very much for being our guest. I look forward to reading your new book.
Oh, thanks so much, Todd.
Hadley Arkus is professor of jurisprudence at Amherst College, Vaughan Fellow in the James Madison Program at Princeton University, author of the new book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, and architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. When we come back from this break, we have open lines for your questions and your comments. Our phone number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's a brilliant argument. I want to talk a bit about that when we come back. The natural rights and the right to choose. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How does a Christian behave ethically in the workplace when compromise and cutting corners seems to be the order of the day? Can a Christian behave ethically and still compete in the world of business? Christian Ethics in the Workplace by Ray Hilgert, Jim Truesdell, and Pastor Phil Lockus is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can order the book online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. The workplace can be an ethical maze. Learn how to navigate it with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear that world events are giving Christians more chances to share Christ. Ron Nicholas is president of Educational Services International, and he says they're sending Christians to teach English to refugees living in the country of Hungary.
People have had to flee from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Sudan to escape some of the Muslim extremists and pressures that have been put upon them. And that's opened an opportunity for people like yourself to go to Hungary, a very peaceful, neutral country, and have the chance to share your life and your faith through teaching English to these people.
Pray for Christians to use their skills in teaching so others can hear about Christ. Learn more by calling ESI at 1-800-895-7955, 800-895-7955, or on the internet at teachoverseas.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. My deep respect goes out to every man and woman whose whole being is caught up in a struggle against alcoholism. Dr. Robert Smith and William Wilson founded Alcoholics Anonymous on this date, June 10th, in 1935. 4 years later, Dr. Bob wrote, "It was really a horrible nightmare, this earning money, getting liquor, smuggling it home, getting drunk, morning jitters, taking large doses of sedatives to make it possible for me to earn more money, and so on, ad nauseum." Truly a nightmare. You can read about it, as I did, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Is the nightmare affecting you or a loved one? Dr. Bob wrote, "If you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink." And then Dr. Bob closes with this, "Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down."
What faith is, and we're talking about saving faith here, is not a belief in a God that can do anything in your life if you only help him out a little bit, or request him to, or if you have enough faith. But faith is trusting Jesus' death on the cross to have you right with God.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. Coming off that conversation with Hadley Arkus, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and author of this new book. I can't wait to read it because Scott Klusendorf gave us a little heads up. And, of course, Hadley just gave us a bit of a preview, too. The book is called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose. I'd like your reaction to that interview. If you're so inclined, the phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I have a few items I'd like to use to follow up on that particular conversation in just a moment. But first of all, the basic argument that Hadley is making in this new book is brilliant. And if you didn't catch it when he was explaining it, let me see if I can put it in the simplest possible terms. In order to argue for a right to choose, one has to argue against natural rights. Now, I'm not talking about natural law. I'm talking about natural rights, those rights that, whether you believe in God or whether you believe man simply popped into existence out of a cabbage patch, doesn't matter, rights that devolve to human beings because they are human beings. You possess them essentially. You possess them as part and parcel of being a human being. That's natural rights. The simplest statement of natural rights in our American context is, of course, from our founding documents. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's how we put it in our American context. But it's no different than simply saying, because human beings are human beings, they possess certain rights. Not all rights necessarily. Not every right in the world. I mean, not the right to go off and kill someone else. And not the right to say, have people give you money for no reason. But certain inalienable rights that were so self-evident to the founders of this country, they didn't even feel the need to enumerate them beyond life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was so self-evident. Now, in order to argue for a right to choose, the pro-abortion camp has argued against natural rights. They've done it in this way. That human being in the womb does not inherently possess, because that human being is a human being, any rights or protections. Now, here's the brilliant part of Hadley's argument. That in arguing against the rights which a human being in the womb naturally possesses, the woman's right to choose has no longer any basis. They cannot argue for the right to choose as an inalienable right because they have already swept away the argument of inalienable rights, of natural rights. There are no rights. If the human being, and it's so fundamental, if the human being in the womb does not, by the very fact that it is a human being, he or she is a human being, possess these rights, then none of us can be said to possess these rights naturally, because after all, when did you get the right? If you don't have it from the moment of conception, you're never going to pick it up. There are only two kinds of rights. Hadley was very clear about that. The kind you're born with, or we should say, the kind you're conceived with, and the kind which devolved to you from government. And that is things like the right to get in your car and drive around on the roads. They give you a license. You now have the right to drive a car in this nation. Now, which is it? Is the right to choose given you by government? Or are you conceived with it? Either way, the pro-choice camp loses. Because if they say, well, it's a right that is given to us by government, well, that right can be taken away then. A woman doesn't necessarily then have an inalienable right to choose because it was given to her at some time subsequent to her conception. And if they say the right to choose is yours, is a woman's from the time she is conceived, well, then if she's got a right to choose from the time she's conceived, she certainly must have the right to live from the time she's conceived, right? Brilliant. Brilliant. We need more guys like Hadley Arkus. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Can't wait to read the book. Can't wait to get him back on the air to talk about it. April is calling from Manchester. April, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Pastor, hi. How are you?
I'm very good.
Good, good. I am so relieved that you brought him on to the program and the words that he shared. I am in complete agreement with him, painfully to a fault, that it is homicide. And the more we come to terms with realizing that life is a privilege and a blessing, the more perhaps hearts will change. I was wanting to add to the discussion, it's probably already known, but in the state of Missouri, I believe that it is manslaughter, whether first, second, or third degree, for an unborn child to be killed in the event of an accident of various kinds. Are you up to date on that?
Well, April, I wish I were more up to date on the particulars of the Missouri law, and I'm going to go only by the vaguest of recollections, and that is that Missouri is one of those states. In fact, let me reach over here real quick.
Okay, great.
Missouri is one of those states, and I'm looking at the Newsweek article that we were talking about, and it's one of the blue states, and according to the blue states, I'll read directly from here.
Okay.
It says, fetal laws of the land. 28 states now criminalize harm to a fetus. Congress is expected to pass the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, now called the Lacey and Conner Law, after the Petersons in the case. Now, the blue states on the map do make it a law to harm a fetus at any stage in pregnancy. So you are correct when you say that Missouri has some law, I don't know the particulars of that law or laws, mm-hmm. that makes it a crime, I don't know if it's a misdemeanor or a felony, to harm a fetus in the womb at any stage in pregnancy.
Mm.
Now, other states put it after the embryonic stage. Some put it after the first trimester. Some put it after a certain number of weeks. Some put it in the second trimester. Some have no laws at all.
Mm, God help them. I think manslaughter is in the category of a felony, a lower grade of a felony. But, yes, may those laws continue to stick. Hmm?
Yes, April, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. God bless you.
God bless you, too. You know, this is something that I live with every day, this contrast. The state I live in and the state I work in. I live in Illinois. I work in Missouri. A lot of people do that. That's not any big deal. But when you talk about the issue of life, it's like living in two different worlds. It really is. Illinois, by the way, is one of those states that does have protections for the fetus in the commission of a crime if there's harm done the fetus. But note the chasm between that law, that I'm glad Illinois has that law, to harm a fetus is to commit a crime. Except when the woman says she doesn't want the baby and you can just go right over to Granite City and have your baby aborted. There's no crime there in Illinois. In fact, you don't even have to tell the girl's mother or husband or boyfriend or father or anyone for that matter. And you can also transport a minor child into Illinois for an abortion without anyone knowing, and it's not illegal. And yet, ironically, they have a law in Illinois that says if a fetus is harmed in the commission of a crime or an accident, it is a crime. Go figure. There is no figuring it, folks. It's just a rank inconsistency. One that needs to be resolved in favor of protecting the fetus, not only when its mother wants the fetus, but also when the mother doesn't want the baby either. 505-780-1800-730-2727. By the way, I would like to point out for those of you who feel as April did, thankful for the Hadley Arkus interview. Hadley is not a Christian. But he is one of the best voices for life out there. Some of our strongest allies may exist outside the Christian circles in the pro-life movement. He's certainly one of the most concise thinkers when it comes to that. I asked Hadley the question about whether or not the ban on partial birth abortion that last week passed the House has already passed the Senate, will go to conference committee and to the president's desk. Hadley said, well, the thing is going to get enjoined by a court before it ever gets a chance to actually be put in practice. The president will sign it, of course. But once it's signed, someone will go to a friendly court and someone will see to it that there's an injunction against the law. It'll get hung up there, eventually probably make it back to the Supreme Court. Now, supporters of this partial birth abortion ban are rather confident that if it gets to the Supreme Court, which it most certainly will, it will be able to pass, even this present court, even without figuring for a replacement on the court, even without figuring for a more pro-life court, they believe it has what it takes to pass. Remember, there was a Nebraska law banning partial birth abortion that the court knocked down because they believed that it would have infringed upon Roe. And that knocked down a bunch of laws all over the place that ban partial birth abortion. This one has been written with the Supreme Court's eyes in mind, with the Supreme Court's arguments and thinking in mind. The story very briefly, 3 years after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Nebraska's prohibition on partial birth abortion, supporters and opponents of the ban are ready and gearing up for a legal battle over a federal law passed by Congress. This time, however, pro-life groups say the measure passed by the House of Representatives Wednesday last week, after winning Senate approval in March, meets the standard set down by the Supreme Court in the Nebraska case, which was Steinberg v. Carhart. Jay Sekulow, by the way, of the American Center for Law and Justice, the ACLJ, says, Because the way this one has been carefully drafted, it meets the constitutional standards of the Supreme Court. You've got a record that's been bolstered. You've got a procedure that's been closely defined. You've got a life for the mother exception. And that qualifies for Supreme Court precedent. Now, pro-life advocates acknowledge that when the Supreme Court heard the arguments in the Nebraska case, the justices had little evidence to show why the ban was needed to protect a woman's health. But since then, the 104th, 105th, and 107th Congress have held hearings to bolster that contention. In other words, there's just more evidence that partial birth abortion is unnecessary, at the very least. And in addition to hearing testimony about the dangers of the procedure, the measure adopted by both houses of Congress also includes a provision allowing doctors to carry out partial birth abortion if a woman's health is at risk. And we may be safe actually allowing that to remain in there. Why? Because the evidence shows there is no conceivable circumstance under which a woman could carry a child to the term where to the place in the term where it would be a partial birth abortion, where she wouldn't also be able to safely give birth to the child alive. I mean, think about it. If she can deliver the child to be killed, she can deliver the child to live. It's that simple. I'm not a lawmaker, I'm not a lawyer, and I understand that. Doctors who performed the procedure according to the ban that was passed by the House last week face a fine and up to 2 years in jail, but the bill also states that the ban, quote, does not apply to a partial birth abortion that is necessary to save the life of a mother whose life is endangered. Now remember, this isn't just a health provision. This is to save the life of the mother whose life is endangered. While Sekulow believes that this definition addresses the concerns expressed by the Supreme Court in its 2000 decision on the Nebraska case, an attorney who was co-counsel to the Nebraska abortion provider, Dr. Leroy Carhart, said that the bill still fails to meet the court standard for a health exception. Priscilla Smith, director of the Domestic Legal Program at the Center for Reproductive Rights, said that the Supreme Court made it clear that if lawmakers are going to regulate abortion, the measure would have to promote women's health, not put it in danger. Now, she is making a huge assumption there, don't you think? She's assuming that a woman whose life will somehow be endangered if she carries the child to term, gives and delivers the child to be born alive, but somehow her health will be enhanced if she carries the child to term and delivers the child to be killed. I don't see how that affects her health one bit. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. I am very sad to report that when the Presbyterian Church USA met for its 215th General Convention, General Assembly in Denver, among all the other things we talked about last week, of the things that they did decide, the maneuverings of the pro-homosexual lobby there who wants to see gay clergymen and gay same-sex unions and things like that, one of the things that they did do was to reaffirm support for partial birth abortion. They issued a statement last week reaffirming the support of the Presbyterian Church USA for partial birth abortion in most cases. The church is calling it a compromise between its older pro-abortion announcement and the concerns of pro-life Presbyterians, usually led by a group called Presbyterians Pro-Life. The resolution echoes a statement adopted by last year's assembly. It also incorporates some of the substance of an overture, which sought to limit recourse to abortion in cases where the baby may be able to live outside the womb. By a 59-17 vote, the General Assembly there in Denver last week of the Presbyterian Church USA said again, even though it backed off a bit, said again that it supports partial birth abortion. Not the ban on partial birth abortion, they support the procedure. The largest Presbyterian church body in the United States. You know, I got an email from someone this last week. They said, look, I was looking over your church body's website on the issue of life. This was a person, I believe they said they were a Roman Catholic, and they said the only thing keeping them in the Roman Catholic Church at that point was the Roman Catholic Church's position on the life issue. And they said, I was looking over your church body's, not my congregations, but my church body, my denomination's website on the issue of life. And they were concerned because there was unclear language about contraception on that website. I agree, there is unclear language there. There needs to be more clarity about contraception, making distinctions between contraception that is essentially abortion and contraception that really does prevent conception. There's a big moral line between those two. We've talked about that before. And I'm very fine with answering an email like that, and I understand the concern. And yet at the same time, while I was sitting typing this response, literally in the very hours I was typing this response, the largest Presbyterian church body in the United States was saying that partial birth abortion is a good idea in most cases. A new Gallup poll shows that most Americans oppose most abortions. Now, these things can be tricky. So let's see what the details are. A new poll by the Gallup organization reveals that most Americans, this is as of June 1st, by the way, so it's not that old, most Americans continue to oppose most abortions. Conducted from May 5th through the 7th, the poll shows little change in Americans' attitudes on abortions compared with the same time last year. Americans remain closely divided over the leading abortion debate positions. Some 48% of them are labeling themselves pro-choice. 45% are calling themselves pro-life. Now, there's got to be something going on here. There's got to be something going on here. A near 50-50 split on those who call themselves pro-life as opposed to pro-choice, with a slight edge, 3%, which is within the margin of error, I believe, on this particular poll. So a 50-50 split in Americans who call themselves pro-life and pro-choice, and yet most of them say they oppose most abortions. 61% of Americans want abortion to be illegal in all circumstances. 61%. Now, somehow, a person who holds that opinion can still call themselves pro-choice. I don't know how that is. Or 19% of them say that they want it to be legal only in very few circumstances. I'm sorry, no, that's 42% only want it to be legal in very few circumstances. Only 38% of Americans support abortion being legal in most circumstances or in all circumstances. Only 22% said all circumstances abortion should be legal. You know, we've got these labels, pro-life and pro-choice, and I've pointed this out many times on the air. We've got these two labels, but never for a minute believe that these labels, when someone says, oh, I'm pro-life, that they're necessarily saying the same thing you mean when you say you're pro-life. It's kind of like the label Christian. For some, Christian just means, well, yeah, I was born in America, wasn't I? What else would I be? For some, it means something very different than I would confess. I would define my Christianity according to, say, well, the way the church has defined it, according to the historic creeds drawn directly from Holy Scripture. Others would say, no, Christianity is more of a moral system. So the label, even that one label, is very ill-suited to figuring out where someone stands. The same is true of pro-life and pro-choice. A new question in the poll this year finds that Americans are widely supportive of keeping abortion legal throughout pregnancy in cases when the woman's life is endangered, 82%. There's that huge loophole, 82%. And when the pregnancy was caused by rape or incest, 72%. And when the child would be born with a life-threatening illness, 60%. Apart from the legality of abortion, Gallup finds that a majority, that is 53% of Americans personally believe, here's, this is great, I love this, they personally believe that abortion is morally wrong. Just over one-third of them consider it to be morally acceptable. And yet, of those 53% who say, well, we have 53% saying that they personally believe abortion is morally wrong, some of them, because 38% of Americans, some of them say that it should be legal in most cases. There we find the vast middle. Obviously, there's a real problem here in understanding what it means to be pro-life or pro-choice. It also seems to be a real problem in understanding what whether or not you're going to adopt a worldview that says, from the time of conception, a human person is completely worthy of our protection. There is a worldview out there that says, no, they're not. In fact, there are more worldviews out in our culture that say that that little baby doesn't deserve to be protected than there are that say he or she does. If you'd like to hone your skills in recognizing these contradictory worldviews, I would remind you about a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar. It's June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. We've talked about this many times before. The reason there's urgency now is because Friday the 13th, this coming Friday, is the last day you can register for this seminar. For more information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, call the Schwann Center in the next hour, 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, any time of day or night. There you're going to find some information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar later this month at the beautiful Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in northern Wisconsin, just 2 hours north of the Twin Cities. Now, if you are in the greater St. Louis area and you do plan to attend this seminar, I want you to give my producer a call now. The number is area code 314-505-7832. You'll get his voicemail, 314-505-7832, or email him at jschwarz, that's J-S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, at kfuo.org. We have a St. Louis couple who would love to split the transportation costs, the driving time, to this seminar, the Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar in Trago, Wisconsin. The number to call in order to try and connect with this couple, area code 314-505-7832. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we'll be talking about fatherhood. No, we'll be talking about the liturgy with Pastor Will Wheaton. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.